Case for argument this morning is United States against West. Mr. Mullins.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Brian Mullins. I represent Edward West, the appellant in this case. We've raised two issues for appeal: the district court's decision to admit three eyewitnesses to a bank robbery, despite the fact that the district court to admit their in-court identification of Mr. West, despite the fact that it excluded the out-of-court identification of Mr. West at a lineup. The other issue is the sentencing of Mr. West and the procedure the district court used and its reference to Mr. West's socioeconomic condition in what we think is its decision to impose the sentence that it did. I'm going to focus on the lineup aspect of the case unless the court has questions about the sentencing aspect of the case.
You said a moment you thought there was a problem with the sentencing procedure.
Correct. We think it was a procedural error for the court to consider the defendant's socioeconomic status.
Frankly, that doesn't strike me as a procedural argument so much as an argument that this is a prohibited consideration. Whether that's what happened is another question, but I was surprised that you described it as a procedural problem.
Well, I think it's procedural in that the failure to consider a 3553A factor is a procedural error, and I think considering a prohibited factor should therefore also be considered a procedural error. I think it's akin to failing to consider a 3553A factor. So that's why we are describing it as a procedural error rather than overall substantive reasonableness.
Does anything turn on the difference?
Well, then you don't address substantive reasonableness if it's considered a procedural error, is our position, unless if the procedural error is egregious. According to the court's recent case by the court, I believe it was Glosser, where the court stated that if a procedural error is found, it will not consider substantive reasonableness if the procedural error is egregious. And I think for a district court to consider a prohibited factor such as socioeconomic status, race, national origin, and creed is an egregious procedural error, and so therefore the court should not even address the substantive reasonableness of the overall sentence.
Okay, I understand your position. I don't want to distract you from the identification issue.
Very well, thank you. As far as the identification issue goes, I think it's clear from the record that the district court confused the issue of suggestiveness with the issue of whether the government established by clear and convincing evidence that there is an independent basis for the witness's identification of Mr. West, independent from the line of identification itself. And the statements that the district court made, I think, show this. The district court stated, "There was nothing about the lineup, the way it was conducted, to suggest that an in-court identification of the defendant would be tainted. Hence, it is possible for in-court identification to occur." And at a later hearing, the court was asked to clarify its ruling, and it stated, "Prior contact with the defendant has not been shown to be such that witnesses should be precluded from identifying Mr. West at trial." So I think the court was focused on the procedures of the identification process itself rather than...
Did he ever ask Judge Clifford to make a finding on this issue?
Yes. The government, and we kind of, I think, mixed this up in our brief, and we apologize for that. The first time this issue was addressed was by the government and in subjection to the magistrate judge's recommendation. And it addressed the issue of whether an independent basis could be established. We then responded to the government, and we raised the clear and convincing issue. And Judge Clavert, these were his only rulings on the district court's only rulings on those issues were the two oral statements in court. So there was no written ruling on that. And but the first time the issue was addressed was in the government's objection to the magistrate judge's recommendation.
But you're saying you did raise the clear and convincing standard under Wade?
We did in our response to the government's objection, and that is in the record. It was not included as in the appendix to the brief, but it is in the record. And so that issue was raised to the district court. No hearing was held on that issue. The hearing that was held was before the magistrate judge, and that hearing was strictly to determine, first of all, whether Mr. West's right to counsel had been violated, whether the hearing itself or whether the lineup was suggestive, and if it was suggestive, whether the identification was nonetheless reliable. The magistrate judge found that Mr. West's right to counsel had been violated, that the right to counsel had attached, and he was not provided counsel, and that the lineup was not suggestive. So therefore, the district court or the magistrate judge did not address the Biggers factors of whether, if it was suggestive, the lineup was nevertheless reliable. And then the district court adopted the magistrate judge's recommendation that the lineup was not suggestive, but that Mr. West's right to counsel had been violated. Nevertheless, the district court, I think, implied that, well, because the lineup wasn't suggestive, the witnesses can still identify Mr. West at trial in court, and that's not the proper analysis. The proper analysis is whether, despite the fact that Mr. West's right to counsel had been violated, can the witnesses provide an independent basis for their identification of Mr. West, and that's the government's burden to establish by clear and convincing evidence, and that's what we believe the district court failed to do here.
Mr. Mullins, let me just raise with you and for government counsel something that concerns me here. If we agree with you that no adequate findings were made here to, in essence, find that the counsel problem was harmless, and so the in-court IDs would be allowed, we'd be sending it back to the district court for some fresh findings. As I understand, this issue seems remarkably quintessentially dependent upon evaluations of credibility of the eyewitness testimony. Is that right? Would you agree with that?
And that's why I think...
And Magistrate Judge Goodstein was the one who actually heard their testimony. Judge Clavert did not.
Correct, Your Honor.
And even if we were to remand tomorrow, such a hearing would be 2.5 years after the robberies that occurred and long, long after that hearing. Who should make the findings, Judge Goodstein or Judge Clavert?
I think Judge Clavert should, because he would be the presiding trial judge. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I think it should be Judge Clavert's decision.
Your view is that he has to make that decision de novo, notwithstanding the magistrate's report and recommendation?
Correct. Mm-hmm. I think it's a two-part process, this Wade test. First, you would determine whether the right to counsel has been violated. If so, the burden shifts to the government to show by clear and convincing evidence that, nevertheless, the witness's identification is independently corroborated or independently based. And so the magistrate judge can make this legal determination of whether the right to counsel had been violated, but I think the factual issue of whether there's an independent basis should be made by the presiding trial judge, and that would be our request, at least. And I think that's why I know there's a suggestion that this court should make a de novo determination, but I think, as the court mentioned, it's such a determinative of credibility. For example, Ms. Amore, who on paper said she was 100% sure that Mr. West was the bank robber. Well, my recollection is that she was very nervous in her demeanor and seemed much less than 100% sure. Now, that's my recollection, and doesn't mean much here, but you don't see that on paper, and that's why appeals courts defer to district courts to make these factual findings. I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins. Ms. Domasek,
please
do not touch the microphone.
I apologize. May it please the Court, my name is Bridget Domasek. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I appear on behalf of the appellee, United States of America. Good morning.
Please center yourself at the podium, and that way you'll be recorded by the microphone and amplified.
Certainly, Your Honor. First, Your Honors, the district court correctly held that the witnesses to the bank and credit union robberies could be permitted to testify at the defendant's trial and to make an in-court identification of him. Additionally, the district court correctly...
Where did the district court make the finding required by Wade?
Your Honor, the district court made the finding required by Wade two different times. One was at the change of plea on September 21st, and the other was at a status conference in June. At those hearings, the court said... Thank you. First, I do not believe the government has shown that the magistrate's ruling is incorrect. I don't believe, well, the lineup should have been conducted with an attorney there. It certainly was not. But there was nothing about the lineup, the way it was conducted, to suggest that an in-court identification of the defendant would be tainted. Hence, it is possible.
That is not the finding required by Wade.
Your Honor, I would respectfully argue that that is a sufficient finding in connection with the later finding that's made on September 21st, which is the prior contact with the defendant has not been, was not shown to be such that the witnesses should be precluded from being given the opportunity to view the defendant.
That isn't a finding at all. That's just a restatement of the conclusion. It's not a finding of fact.
Your Honor.
Look, as I see it, the problem in this case is not necessarily lack of evidence. Your brief just ignores the fact that the district court didn't make the finding. You say there's plenty of evidence that would support a finding that the in-court testimony was not influenced by the lineup. And there may be plenty of evidence to support such a finding. I just can't find it. Can't find the finding.
Your Honor, my brief hinges primarily upon the Anderson case. And in the Anderson case, this court held that where there's an adequate factual basis and the arguments have been carefully constructed to allow for passage on that issue, that an appellate court may reach the Wade issue. And for various reasons, I think that's appropriate today, and I'll go into them to start with. First of all, there's record evidence to support a finding that the witnesses had an independent recollection aside from the unlawful lineup.
I doubt there's any disagreement on the court on that point about whether there's sufficient evidence to support it. The question is whether that's a finding that we can make when the district court did not,
Your
particularly
Honor,
given the clear and convincing evidence standard.
I would refer this court to the magistrate's findings that are in as a result of the evidentiary hearing. In the facts, findings of fact that the magistrate set out, it addressed, first, the prior opportunity of the witnesses to view the defendant. Second, the lapse of time between the crime and the lineup identification. And also discussed that the witnesses were 100% certain in their identifications. Although no legal conclusion was drawn in the analysis section, these facts are clearly set forth by the magistrate. I'll go into them in a little bit of detail, but I'm sure you're familiar with them. First, with respect to Ms. Graham, at record at 31, defendant was 3 feet away from her. The encounter lasted 2 minutes. The bank was well lit. The robber was over 6 feet tall, and he had acne scars.
Right. Why didn't you ask did you ask the district judge to make the Wade finding?
I did ask the district judge, and my objection to the magistrate's report and recommendation. And furthermore, Your Honor, I requested that the magistrate make this finding. Now, at that time, notably, the government asked to make a reliability finding under Neal versus Biggers. And the factors in Neal and the factors in Wade are distinguishable. However, this was clearly teed up for the magistrate, and it was clearly teed up for the district court.
So they swung and missed?
Well, no, I think that there is an indication, many indications actually, that the district court understood exactly what was going on. First of all, in the government's objection to the magistrate's report and recommendation, we only argued for a finding of Wade reliability. The defendant in its response argued Wade had not been satisfied because the witnesses viewed the defendant at the lineup and at the magistrate hearing, and therefore they could not be reliable. The court, in ruling on this issue, implicitly incorporated those arguments on September 29th when he said the prior contact with the defendant has not been, was not shown to be such that the witnesses should be precluded from being given the opportunity to view the defendant and to determine if he's indeed the person they saw and the person they would implicate as one of the bank robbers. Furthermore, Your Honor, as set forth in United States versus Anderson, even if this court does not find that implicit in Judge Clevert's finding that the teller should be permitted to testify at trial, there is an adequate basis for the reasons I just set forth, and the arguments were clearly crafted. I'll just, if I may, just briefly quote from Anderson. The court in Anderson held that, Even if the court had failed to do this, which is to make the explicit Wade findings, which the district court did not do in Anderson, such a lapse would not amount to reversible error, for it is open to this court to determine whether the requirements of Wade were satisfied, at least where, one, the record on this point is adequate and was indeed carefully constructed to facilitate passage of this issue. I would argue respectfully that both prongs of this test, if you will, set forth in Anderson have been satisfied.
Can we do that without evaluating the credibility of the witnesses?
You know, Your Honor, I heard you ask that question earlier, and I wanted to respond to that. When you posed that question earlier to Attorney Mullins, he responded that, yes, they depend on credibility determinations, but I would respectfully disagree for a couple of reasons. If you look at what the Wade factors are, for example, this time between when the crime occurred and when the lineup happened, that requires no credibility determination at all. Mr. Mullins mentioned that one of the things that he noticed at the evidentiary hearing was that Ms. Amore seemed somewhat shaken a little bit when she said that her identification was 100% positive. Well, that's not a Wade factor. I mean, it kind of weighs in our favor. On the other hand, it's not a Wade factor. If you just give me a moment, there are additional Wade factors, that I do not believe are credibility determinations. For example, if there was a prior photograph identification, I don't see where a credibility determination would come in here. So, for example, at the evidentiary hearing, Ms. Graham, Ms. Puse, and Ms. Amore were asked, did you watch a video? Did you see the bank robbery or credit union robbery videos before coming to the lineup? And they all three, well, excuse me, two of them said no. One said, yes, I did, but it wasn't to refresh my recollection. To the extent that they admitted or denied whether they watched the video, I don't know that I see that as a credibility determination. So,
I assume that there was no disguise or anything. This is face-to-face, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And so the video, although I don't think it's clearly set forth in the record, depicts the face of the perpetrator of the robberies. I see that I'm getting close to my time, and I'd just like to briefly touch upon the sentencing here. Sentencing in this case, even though the defendant's need for medical treatment was discussed and also combined with his financial ability to pay for his medical needs, was reasonable and permissible because it touched upon a permissible sentencing factor, namely the factor set forth in 3553A, which is the ability or, the need for medical treatment. And there are other courts who have held that it's okay to discuss a defendant's financial situation when it touches on a permissible sentencing factor, such as the need for medical treatment. Furthermore, the record is clear that the district court did a thorough discussion of the other 3553A factors, such as the need to protect the public, the need to impose punishment, the defendant's nature and characteristics. So for all these reasons, I respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Mullins?
I think credibility is always an issue, even if these weight factors are black and white as the government indicates, because even a black and white issue, the court has to determine if a witness is telling the truth and whether the witness is able to remember accurately. And so I think credibility is always an issue, and the district courts are in a better position to assess that than this court. In Anderson, the district court held an evidentiary hearing specifically addressed to determine the independent basis for the identification. The district court did not make a finding, but it held a hearing, and so there was a record made. And the case that Anderson relied upon to find that de novo review could be had in such a situation was X. Rel. Harris, a case from this court in 1972, which was a habeas case where a hearing was also held in the state court of the trial court in state court in Illinois, and that a hearing was held there specifically addressed to this independent basis issue. So I think this case is distinguishable from both Harris and Anderson because no hearing was held specifically addressed to this issue. That's all I have. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.